All right, so I hope everybody enjoyed Sukkot and is now ready for us to buckle down to the work of actually reading this book. We spent 2 weeks doing an introduction, and I actually wanted to add one piece to the introduction, which I saw after we had gone through those 2 weeks, and it's really, I think it's important. It's regarding the message of the book of Iyov, the book of Job. Rebecca had asked me during class a couple of weeks, well, now it's a few weeks ago, whether there are analogous texts to the book of Job with a similar storyline in the ancient Near East. And I said that I've looked around and I haven't really found any, which was true at the time. But I did come across one finally from a fellow who I wrote his name down here as Simon N. Kramer. For some reason in my notes I have written as Samuel Noah Kramer, but I think Simon is actually correct. If you take a look at source number one on the sheets, I did put some extras in the corner over there. Take a look at what Kramer writes about a text from Sumerian literature, Sumerian wisdom text as they call it. The book he's describing, or it's not a book exactly, but it's a long poem, is called Man and His God. That's the name of it. And Kramer is of the belief that this is analogous to the book of Job. I want your feedback on whether you believe that. Alina can't answer because she's heard me speak about this on Yom Kippur, so you can't answer. But everybody else can, about whether this sounds like Job to you or not. He writes, structurally speaking, our poetic tract may be tentatively divided into five sections, not the book of Job, but the Sumerian work. First comes a brief introductory exhortation that man should praise and exalt his God and soothe him with lamentations. I don't know exactly what soothing with lamentations means, but soothe him with lamentations. The poet then introduces the unnamed individual who, upon being smitten with sickness and misfortune, addresses his God with tears and prayers. That's the second part. He's suffering, and he turns to his God with prayers. There follows the sufferer's petition, which constitutes the major part of the poem. He turns to his God and says, "Help me." It begins with a description of the ill treatment accorded him by his fellow men, friend and foe alike, continues with a lament against his bitter fate, including a rhetorical request to his kin and to the professional singers to do likewise, and concludes with a confession of guilt and a direct plea for relief and deliverance. That's in this work. Finally comes the happy ending, in which the poet informs us the man's prayer did not go unheeded, and that his God accepted the entreaties and delivered him from his afflictions. All this leads, of course, to a further glorification of his God. That's the description of the Sumerian work. Does this sound like the book of Job to you?
One difference.
One difference, Ralph says. I hear a yes, and I hear one difference. Yeah.
He confesses his guilt. That's not in Job.
He confesses his guilt. That's not in Job. What else? I see differences. I see loads of differences.
Well, he's not really guilty, Job, but this man
appears to be guilty. Well, the jury is out on Job's guilt. We don't actually know yet because we have to get through 42 chapters first before we can be judging. We haven't heard the opening or closing arguments yet. Right, although we're going to see Job get smitten too. We're going to get Job himself well too, so that we will see. Yeah?
All the actors that...
Right, all the dialogues are missing. That's true. Now, I should note that there is a school among the biblical critics who say that that's the Jewish part, and that the Jews took the frame of the story from elsewhere and then just inserted the dialogues. So that will be consistent with this idea if we accepted that as the explanation. But there's something else that's really important here that's missing. And I can't really blame you because we haven't actually, cracked the book. But but what's missing here is that in this work, this Sumerian work, the fellow who is suffering turns to God for help. He says, "God help me," and God helps him. In Sefer Iyov, the book of Job, Job does not turn to God and ask for help. His anger is there from the get-go, number one. And number two, God's not helping him either. There is the benefit he gets at the end, but that, whether that's a response to his prayers or not is something we need to see. It's certainly not a response to a request. In other words, I believe that... Well, first of all, I believe this is not the book of Job. What you're seeing in this Sumerian work reflects a relatively simplistic approach in which we are told you should always praise your God. Look at this person as an example. He was struck with misfortune, he turned to his God for help, and his God helped him, and he lived happily ever after. Right? That's what you're seeing there.
But that's not what usually happens.
Well, it's certainly not common experience. Maybe it was in Sumeria, I can't say. But also, it's not what it says in Job. In Job, he suffers. There is no apparent connection between his own deeds and what God brings upon him. And he himself complains about that. And when, in fact, he benefits at the end, it's not a result of his asking for help at all. It seems to be a result of his challenging God, that he is helped. And so what comes to mind for me, actually, is a rather different way to look at Sefer Iyov, at this book. And what I have in mind, I think makes a lot of sense, but I must acknowledge that it's my idea, and therefore it could be shot down tomorrow, or today, if we get lucky. But we have, within Torah, ideas, mitzvot especially, which are meant to counter those of the societies that surround the Jewish people. So Rambam frequently says regarding a mitzvah, this mitzvah was meant to counter the influence of the Egyptians. The Egyptians did it this way, the Egyptian priests cut their hair this way, therefore Jewish men are supposed to not. They're supposed to cut their hair in this way. These cultures worshipped the cow, therefore Jews are supposed to bring the cow as an offering to God, as a way to make a statement against that culture. We find that idea throughout Tanakh. The book of Bereishit, the first book in the Torah, introduces us to the people of Canaan, the various nations the Jews will meet later who will be their neighbors, and we are told all about what they are like, and therefore what you are not supposed to be like. We find that consistently through the Torah. There are many, many examples we could bring of this, and I wonder if Job is not an example of it as well. In other words, I wonder if the complexity of this book and the challenge of seeing somebody suffering, and it has no relationship with good or bad, and his response to God is in fact to challenge, and God accepts this challenge of his and rejects the moralizers who try to preach to him. To my mind, it's entirely possible that the book of Job is included in Tanakh to tell us, don't listen to what they're saying out there. Don't listen to the Sumerian book. Don't listen to these others, because suffering and the events of this world are more complex, and the Jew is not supposed to give in to that. You could also make the argument, I think I had mentioned it last time, that in a sense this is also a response to Tehillim. We've talked about that already, because Tehillim has this approach of turning to God with faith when you're suffering, and Job seems to reflect the opposite. But that's just one last piece for the introduction that I wanted to make sure to add. But let's actually read the book.
Can I just say, yeah, what I like about Job more than this?
Yes.
Is that Job is named.
Yeah.
And there it's an unnamed individual.
Right. True. And that actually was a point that the Talmud specified when they were debating, was he a real person or not? It was brought as evidence that he was real. Yeah, what is the fact that he's named and we get a name of his location and so on. More about that actually coming soon. No, it's true. It certainly marks this as different. And yeah, we like to have names on our characters, although, you know, it doesn't always work that way. Okay, let's take a look at the book. What I'd like to start out with is having us read the opening 5 verses. We are not going to end up reading all 42 chapters line by line, just because if we do, we will be here for several years. And, you know, that's great, but, you know, I would feel bad So what we're going to end up doing is, once we get into the dialogues, we'll be doing chunks of verses in which we will have read them ourselves, and I will explain what's in them, but we're not going to do the line-by-line read. But for the opening section, you have to, because there's so much going on in setting this up. So let's take a fast look at the opening five psukim, the opening five sentences. We'll do Hebrew and English, and then we're going to ask some questions about this. Ish hayav eretz Utz, Iyov Shemo. There was a man in the land of Utz. His name was Job. V'haya ha'isha utamet v'yashar v'yirei Elokim v'sar meira. And that man was tam, a word which we will render as complete or perfect. Tam can also mean simple. But in the context of the other praises that are found with it, where he is described as being yashar, which is righteous, yirei Elokim, God-fearing, sar meira, staying away from evil, it sounds like this is meant to be a praise of him. This is not meant to say tam in the sense of being a very simple person. This is meant to say tam as a complete person.
Ingenuous.
Well, even stronger than that, I would think. It reflects an innocence which is intentional, not accidental. You know, that's the way I look at it. But we're going to come back to all of this. We're just reading
it's
right now.
It's not naturally good.
Vayivaldulo could be a combination. Vayivaldulo shiva banim v'shalosh banot. He has seven boys and three girls. Kenai Nahara. And there's only one wife, as we'll see in the story. Vayhi mikneu shiv'as alfei tzon u'shloshes alfei gemalim. And among his cattle, he has 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels. The Dot Mikra edition notes that camels are more expensive than sheep, so yeah, it makes sense that you have a ratio like this. V'chamesh meos semed bakar v'chamesh meos asonos. 500 pairs of oxen, they get yoked together. 500 donkeys, female donkeys. V'avudah rabam me'od. And a lot of avudah can be translated as slaves, can be translated as fields also. V'ayhi ha'isha hu gadol mikol b'nei kedem. And he was greater than all of the people of the East. There's an awful lot we have to revisit here. I am reading through this just to get us through the introductory psukim, the introductory verses, and then we're going to review. His seven sons would go make parties. Each one would have a day when he would make a celebration of some kind. And they sent for their three sisters to join with them. So the family all gets along. Right? We already know now why the Gemara says this is a mashal, that this is just a parable. They all 10 siblings go eat together every day of the week, and it all works out. And it would be when they completed the circuit of these days. Notice the word hikifu, right? What word does that remind us of?
Hakafos.
Hakafos, exactly. The term comes from a word for a circuit. Hakafot are the circuits you make, because although no one does this, or few people do this, unfortunately, hakafot are supposed to be you go around the bima. That's where it comes from, like the Hoshana circuits as well. Another word, by the way, that's associated with that is the word tikufa. Right? Tikufa meaning a season. Comes from the same idea. It's the seasons of the year. So, when they completed the circuit of these days of feasts, Vayishlach Iyov Vayikadeshem. Iyov sent and Vayikadeshem. That's not an easy word to translate. I believe that translating it as sanctified them would be a mistake. It's more like he prepared them. We'll come back to the word, though. Vayishkim Babokir, he rose in the morning. Ve'he'ela Olos Mispar Kulam. And he brought Ola offerings. An Ola offering is an offering that is burnt entirely. In other words, the animal is slaughtered, and then the body of it is not shared among the people. You don't get to eat it. It is all burnt on the altar. He brought these offerings according to the number of kids he had. Because Iyov said, maybe my children sinned, and they blessed God in their hearts. This is a common euphemism in Tanakh. When you say to bless somebody, what is actually meant is blasphemy, to curse them. So this is a euphemism. He says, maybe when his children were feasting, maybe they expressed a curse against God. That's his fear. Why in the world would they have done that? Hang on. We may get to that eventually. And kach yaseh Iyov kol hayamim, and this is what Iyov would always do. That's our introduction to Iyov. The next section is going to involve it being called the Satan coming to God and speaking against Iyov. We have to get there, but that's our opening set of verses. What questions should we be asking as we read this? What bothers us about these psukim, about these sentences? Yeah, go ahead.
It doesn't really sound real to me. It sounds more like a story. Like, it's too good to be true. He's so wealthy, the kids get along. You know, it seems more like a story to me.
Yeah, it sounds like it should be with Once Upon a Time.
Yeah, correct.
Right? This is something you read in a book. This is not life.
I think it needs more detail for us to believe it.
What do you mean?
Detail of the surroundings of the actual interactions and so on, so we could believe it better.
Right, although in Tanakh, that's rare. Right? Tanakh rarely spends time on giving me details. Sorry?
No, I was going to say Midrash is what you need to flesh it out.
Right, and Midrash will pick up on there's a missing this here, and there's an odd word there, and that will give me... Right, but in the text of Tanakh, we're generally missing that kind of information. Yeah?
Does that mean that his sons would have, you know, gatherings, and would he be there, or he would not be there?
What do you think? What do you think, based on this?
That he was not there.
He's not there, right?
So that bothers me.
That depends on which generation you are. But that's true. That's true. The point indeed is Eov is not part of this. His wife, by the way, you see, is not here, right? She produced the kids. But she's not here, and we'll have to talk about that when we get to her, which won't be this week. That'll be next week, I hope.
Because these are
that may be true.
Their own households.
But you could still have mentioned her. I mean, you didn't need to say that seven boys and three girls were born to him.
But if there's seven boys and seven girls,
three
girls, so they celebrate every day for 10 days.
What do they do?
No, they celebrate 7 days. Only the males are the hosts.
So what do they do after that? Work?
No, then they go back to the beginning. They're partying every day.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean.
Because their father has hundreds and hundreds of cattle, and you know he's got his fields and he has
slaves. So all the children, they don't need to work.
I don't think they're really eating all day long, but I do think that this displays a certain degree of wealth where they don't have to actually, you know, they don't have to worry about their fields much.
The people who are very wealthy like that don't have to work. Shouldn't they be doing this?
Good question. We're going to get back to that, but in like 20 chapters from now. Because, one of Job's friends, so to speak, is going to charge him with, in fact, not sharing and not helping others, and his response is going to be to talk about the way he shared his wealth with the community. And I think part of that is this sort of supposition that people who live like this probably aren't sharing, and it's not necessarily a correct assumption. Yes?
How about the numbers? Everything goes towards the 10.
Yes, good. Another piece of this, which is remarkable here, is the way the numbers all add up. Right? It's 7 boys and 3 girls. 7 plus 3 is 10. It's 5 of this and 5 of that equals 10. And even when we deal with the cattle, right? And it's 500 pairs, which is 1,000, but it also leaves them being 500, so you can add them to the donkeys, and then you get 1,000 as well. It's all surrounding this base 10 thing. Good. I want to come back to that also. Yes, Joyce.
His reference to his sons having sinned is why he does this. He doesn't reference that he may have sinned.
The concern is maybe my kids did something wrong. Now, if he's not at the feast, and if his concern is because of the feasting, that would make sense. Right? If he's on the outs, and it's the people who are drinking that he's worried about. Right? That's a possibility. But definitely worth thinking about.
Why do you say he wasn't there? It's that Job would stand to summon them.
Yeah.
And he would rise early in the night. So, could he be there?
He could be, but the way it's worded here is that the sons make the feast, and it mentions them inviting their sisters. So invitations are recorded here. It does not say anything about inviting him. And then it says that when they finish the circuit, he sent for them, suggesting that he is, in fact, elsewhere. They've set up their own households. I don't know whether the daughters are married or not. There's no indication. There's no real indication about the sons either.
I just wonder, Joel's attitude towards having all of these wonderful things. Does he humble about it? Is he grateful about it? Is he arrogant about it?
What would you say based on what we've read?
Well, he's crazy. Maybe he's, he doesn't say he's grateful. And, you know, just think his kids are going out and having a good time. And,
Well, they're staying home and having a good time, in fact. But the response I would give is that it says here that he is God-fearing. It says that he is just, he's yashar, and he's bringing offerings to God in case they sinned. I mean, this reflects a very clearly God-centered mindset, I think. Yes?
I was going to say that the negative of his son seems to trouble him.
Right, so that's a really interesting question. When you make a feast, does that automatically reflect decadence? Had I approached this text myself, I might have said no, but if Job is worried that when they were in their feast, they might have said something inappropriate, like, I, you know, expressing blasphemy, then yeah, I think that we are being told something about feasts. Now, feasts, in general, are viewed with suspicion in Tanakh. Think of Kohelet, right? Better to be in the house of mourning in Ecclesiastes than to be in the house of the feast.
Because you could say something that you don't really want to say, but in your, I mean, your drunken stupor, you could say it.
I was waiting for that phrase. Yeah. True. Ralph, and then we're going to go a little further. We're going to start addressing some of this.
How did Job acquire all this wealth?
We don't know. We don't know. Job comes on the scene as a wealthy person. We have no background whatsoever. Yes?
It's very curious to me that he is doing tshuva for them rather than they doing it for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That they are not participating in this religious rite. He's doing it on their behalf.
So I'm not.
Is that normal?
So I would say two things. One is that yes, it's normal for children to do, for parents to try to do things to help their children and do this sort of thing, whether it's good for the kids or not, being a separate point. But I do think that he is training them because look at the wording where we're told he sent for them, he prepared them, and then he, you know, brought these offerings, suggesting that they are participating in the ritual. He's just the one underwriting it. He's the one who's actually bringing the offering. Speaking on their behalf, but with some kind of presence.
He's repeating what he's teaching them.
That we don't know. That we don't know. Ellen, and then we're really going to go forward.
No, I just find it puzzling that Eel, who apparently is so perfect and upright and wonderful, could have 10 in the same paragraph, you know, 10 sinning children. It's a big contrast.
Oh, so in other words, if he's concerned, it depends on how I look at his concern. The question is really what his concern is. In other words, the question is, you have Job with, listed with all of these praises of being so righteous, and then on the other end, you've got 10 sinning kids. But the question is, are they really sinning? Or is it simply his concern that they might have, and they sort of go along with this because this is Dad being really righteous. So, okay, he wants us to participate, we'll go for the ritual, but we know we haven't actually done that. But let's start from the beginning, because there's actually a lot to see here, and I want to get through some of it. Verse 1, right off the bat, there was a man in the land of Uz. I don't know what an Uz is. I don't know where Uz is. If you take a look on your sheet, you see source number 2. I'm not going to have you look up the verses I referenced right now. In an ideal world, I would, but in an ideal world, we'd have more than an hour. So, what I'm going to explain is that these verses in source number 2 support the idea that Uz is an actual place. There is a location, a geographic location, and it is called Uz, because the name Uz appears in Bereshit, in the book of Genesis, multiple times. The first listing that I gave you there, 10:23, he is the firstborn son of Aram. Aram, off in the northeast by the Euphrates. Aram is a land where Lavan will live. Lavan will be the Arami. When Yaakov runs away, he goes to the house of Lavan. That's Aram. Then, on after that, in 22:21, Uz is the first son of Nahor, relative of Abraham, who's also living off in that land. That works. Then, 36:28, Uz is the firstborn son of Dishan, who is of the family of Seir, which is in the south. So now I have really three references, but you can understand them as two geographic regions that are now fitting in there. There's up the northeast by the Euphrates, and then there's down south, the land of Seir. Dat Mikra, their edition of this, points out that it's always a firstborn son. And I don't know if there's anything meant by that, by the fact that Utz, here, this place where this whole thing is going to play out, is the place that's always identified in Tanakh with a firstborn son in particular. As a general rule in Tanakh, firstborn sons don't do well. Generally, you know, it's sort of like in a horror film, there are certain things that are the cues that you know someone is about to, you know, meet their end. So in Tanakh also, there are certain things that are just a warning sign. If you're a firstborn son, you know, you might as well just stop reading there. It doesn't work well. If there's polygamy in the household, that's another one. Just stop reading there. It doesn't work out well. So I don't know if there's anything to read into Utz being a firstborn son. However, the suggestion that emerges from this is that Utz is a place either in the northeast, the Aram area, or somewhere in the land of Edom, this land where Seir is, in the south. I made reference also in source number 2 to a verse from Yirmiyahu, from Jeremiah, which mentions Utz as one of the nations that's going to be punished. We actually even find in Echa, the Book of Lamentations, a reference to Utz as the place where Edom lives. Right? Sisi v'simchi bat Edom yoshevet be'eretz Utz. You should rejoice, daughter of Edom, of Esav, who lives in the land of Utz. So, Utz could be a real place. Rashi says it's up in the northeast in the area of Aram. Rabbi Avram Ibn Ezra says it's in this land of Edom in the south. So, Utz could be a real place, in which case we're just spending a lot of time on geography. However, there is another school of thought, which goes back to the idea, which we saw a while back, that this whole book is meant to be a parable. It's meant to teach me lessons. If the book is meant to teach me lessons, then every name in here is going to have significance, including Utz. Maimonides, Rambam, is of that school. If you take a look at source number 3, please, on your sheet, you see what he writes in his Moreh HaNevuchim, his Guide of the Perplexed. As you can see from the title in number 3, I'm still going back and forth between where to use Hebrew and here where to use English, so we have Rambam, Hebrew title, Guide of the Perplexed, English title. We're working on it. He says, Utchilas ma shetistakel bo. He says, the first thing you should examine about this book is Omro ish haya be'eretz Utz, is the statement that it makes of there was a man in the land of Utz. He vishem mishtateif. It brings a name that has multiple meanings. Rambam is very big in his guide in explaining that words can have multiple meanings, and you always need to be sensitive to what sort of meaning is being used. He says, Utz has multiple possible meanings. Shu Shem Ish, it's the name of a person, and Utz Bechoro, one of the verses I quoted you in source number 2. V'hut Sivui, but it's also an instruction. Be'etza u'behanhaga, regarding counsel and guidance. Utsu etza, right? Remember the verse in Yeshaya, in Isaiah, utsu etza v'tufar, correct? Utsu etza means take counsel. Etza means counsel, advice. Utz means give advice. Uki'ilu yomar, as though it will say, lech histakel v'zot ha'etza v'itbonein bo. It's an instruction to the reader. By saying there was a man in the land of Utz, what it's saying is there was a man in the land in which you should be taking counsel. You should be learning from his story. As the Rambam, as Rambam writes here, examine this, contemplate it. You should be thinking about the issues it raises, and see what the true ideas are. So Rambam says this is a parable, and the name is meant to be analyzed. The name is not meant to be taken as a place name. It's meant to tell me that I should be learning from here. Okay. Eov himself. Oh, in terms of the placement of Eov, of Job, location of Utz, and Utz potentially being in the south, I brought you source number 4 because it's also an interesting thing. regarding where he was, mostly because I like watching Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra make fun of somebody. Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra is a commentator who writes in the 11th century on Tanakh. And there, we could spend an hour talking about his biography. But one thing you need to know about him is that he tells you when he agrees with you, and he will tell you more strongly when he does not agree with you. He will quote sometimes just in order to dismiss something. So here, he points out that there is a work which identifies Iov with someone named Yovav. Yovav ben Zerach was one of the kings of Edom. So if I say that Utz is in the land of Edom, Iov could have been this king, which would make sense with his wealth, from the land of Edom. It would fit. And he says, yeah, there are those who say that. But they're wrong. He says, "V'ha'omer shehu Yovav ben Zerach mi Botzra." Those who say he was Yovav ben Zerach of Botzra, "Shema b'chalom ra'azeh." Maybe he saw that in a dream. "Ki ein lo amay yishayin," because he really has nothing whatsoever to depend on in saying this. He has another place where he says this, and he's even harsher about it. "Lo al divrei hanaviim v'lo ma she'etiku hachachameinu zal." He says there's nothing in the prophets, there's nothing in the ideas recorded by our sages. In fact, the work that he's talking about that makes this allegation that it's Yovav ben Zerach was actually a Greek work on Job. It's not one of ours. And he's quoting this in order to dismiss it. But that's in terms of the location. What about the name Iov? Iov Shemo. What does that name tell you? For Hebrew speakers, what does Iov look like? Av. Interesting. Oyev. Oyev. What is an Oyev?
Enemy.
An enemy, precisely. Iov looks a lot like Oyev, meaning an enemy, a foe. As a matter of fact, the Talmud has a line in which Job turns to God and says, maybe you've confused me for Oyev. And we're going to see that later in the book. It's a while from now. But he's actually going to do that play on words of Iov and Oyev. But that's part of our question of who Iov really is. Is Iov a good guy? Or is Iov a bad guy? So keep that in mind also. Every name here has significance. Okay. We are then told, I'm going to come back to a little bit of this phrase, of this verse, in the, eventually. But V'haya ha'isha hu tam v'yashar. He is described as being tam, which we have taken to mean complete, perfect. Yashar, righteous, walks a straight path. Yirei Elokim, God-fearing. Sar meira, he stays away from evil. Presumably the proliferation of adjectives is meant to say he is unquestionably great, right? Interestingly, the Mitzudat David commentary points out that the traits are also, could be divided into two. On the one hand, he is yashar. Yashar is a term we use for the way one deals with other people. That you're righteous and just. It's a social righteousness. As opposed to yirei Elokim, God-fearing, which is really a term that we associate more with relationship with God. So he is righteous on two axes. He's righteous in terms of how he deals with humanity, and he's righteous also in terms of his dealings with God. And yet, yes?
When you say social, do you also mean moral?
Yes. Well, morality can refer to our relationship to God also. It doesn't have to be limited to our relationship to a human being.
You used the term, you said social, but you didn't use moral.
No, because social describes the relationship with others. He is ethical in his conduct with others. Yeah, we're on the same page. But there's something that's missing here.
Doesn't Yeshua mean straight?
Yes.
So he was a straight person in every respect.
Yes.
That's
yes. But what's missing here? Yeah, Sadiq's not there. Sharon is remembering our discussions about Noach last year. We spent a lot of weeks on that. And it's this week's Torah portion. I hope everyone who was here for Noach last year is going to drag out some of their notes for the Shabbos. And you will definitely respond when people criticize Noach. That's a requirement. But the statement here of Eov is missing tzaddik. Now, tzaddik just means righteous. But what it's really missing, to my mind, is that there's nothing here that's superlatively good. These are traits that we associate with somebody who does no harm. Right? He's God-fearing. Right? He reveres God. That's good. We like that. But it's not... It usually, when we talk about someone who does good, so we define them in terms of giving to others. We define them as loving God. We give something that's more positive. These are he didn't do bad things.
They're abstractions.
Well, I don't know if they're abstractions exactly.
In this context,
they have practicality. But there are no examples yet, except that we're going to get to the one with the offerings. So we'll see that.
How do you get better than perfect, though?
Because Tom suggests unblemished. It suggests he didn't do anything bad. Right? It doesn't necessarily mean he did something good. I would like to see something...
So that you think this is not a good English translation?
What does it say in English?
Perfect.
Right. No, well, perfect, it means perfect in the sense of being unblemished. The word perfect itself is a word that admits of multiple meanings. Yes?
I'm just looking at whatever book is on Sino.
Yeah.
And he says that Job, since God is the only one that can be perfect, so Job is presented to us as a man of complete human integrity.
Yeah.
And God, and the word perfect shouldn't be left up to God.
Yeah, and using the word perfect is kind of a loaded word, but I think the translations that use it simply mean unblemished. They're not suggesting divine perfection for him. But I hear them not wanting to use it. I usually shy away from it and use the word complete as my preferred translation for Tom. Yeah?
He would rise early in the morning, which is reminiscent of Abraham.
Mm. True. When we get to the offerings, point out that he's rising early in the morning. This is true. But before we get to the offerings, take a look at sentence number 2. Lots of kids. In the number 10, generally speaking, 10 is meant to connote what? Well, Pruvu, he has definitely reached that one. And then some. And he paid yeshiva tuition for all 10. No. Excuse me, he's Tom. He paid yeshiva tuition for everybody. Now, the question of the 10, I think, is an interesting one. What does 10 connote?
Minyan.
Well, that's for us, yes. Well, in Tanakh, what does 10 connote? Well, we have loads of examples. 10 Makot in Egypt. Right, the 10 plagues. Yeah. The ability to... To sway? What do you mean?
I'm thinking of...
Yeah, no, you're right.
I just can't.
In Sodom, if there are 10 righteous people, and the reverse, there are 10 bad spies who manage to convince the Jews, right? 10, as a general rule, is connotes some kind of completeness and perfection. Now, 7 does also. We see 7s used that way, 7 days of creation, and 7 for the Shemitah cycle, and 7s show up that way as well, and of course you have the seven males. My point isn't to say that it's only a property of 10, but I think here we're meant to get the sense of completeness, and yes, that adds to the storybook type of a conception here. It's just right. There aren't 501, there are 500. Yeah, it sort of lends itself to that kind of a read. So I think the idea of completeness, and I think that's also reflected in the persuasion element that you find with the spies as well as with Sodom, the idea that they are a complete group and they are now an influence on others. He's also described as being greater than the people of the East. So we don't know whether this means greater in wealth, which would fit the context. It could mean greater in wisdom, because we do find in Malachim Aleph that the people of the East are described as being very wise. Don't know. But he is head and shoulders, so to speak, above those around him. and his kids have daily feasts, and this is a regular occurrence, right? Because we're told this is what would go on, and they would complete a cycle, and then they and Job would bring these offerings. The idea of sending for their sisters in this, sorry? Well, we don't know. We know nothing else about what they do, and they're going to be dead soon, so we're never going to find out. That's not a joke. That's not funny. The whole idea of sending for the sisters is an interesting one. I tried to find anyone who would comment on this. I couldn't really find anything to do with it. But, you know, I don't know if the sisters are single. You know, I don't know if the sisters are living, where are they living exactly that they have to send for them? And sending for them suggests like it was a surprise, but they're doing this every week. Like, you know, on Wednesday you're going to so-and-so's house. It's just, you know, the system. So I'm not clear on what this means, unless it means that they felt the area might be dangerous, and therefore they would send an escort, you know, to bring them. That's a possibility. We don't get enough information here to really know what that is about. Dat Mikra is of the belief, though, that as we suggested before, Job himself, is not participating in the meals. This is a sibling thing. And the father, being a good father, is willing to help the siblings develop their relationships by staying at a remove and letting them, you know, do this themselves. Until after the parties are over, and then it's time to atone for whatever it is that they've done. I'm curious, when you have in sentence 5, Vayikadashem, how do your various editions translate that word, Vayikadashem? Job sent, and he what?
Sanctified.
Sanctified? Sanctified is in which edition? The current edition?
JPS.
JPS is sanctified also? Okay, Sansino does sanctified? I am so disappointed. What is the art?
Some of them.
Well, that's the one before it, right? Job sent, and what does it say? Or no, is that?
No,
would send to summon them. Bravo, art scroll.
That's actually.
Yeah, well, that's the Art Scroll edition. I am actually, that to me makes the most sense. The idea of sanctifying them, well, let's take it both ways, because you could read it both ways. You could read it as sanctified them in the sense that he purifies them to prepare them for bringing the offering, much as the Jews go through a period of Kiddush, let's say, before they receive the Torah at Sinai. So there is a concept of Kiddush, of sanctification, that this could mean. But more broadly, the word lekadesh is often meant to connote simply preparation. Not sanctification as much as preparation for something. I gave you a couple of references in source number 5. One is from when they received the Torah, another is from when they dedicated the Mishkan, the tabernacle. But he does something to prepare them for the bringing of the offering. They are involved in the ritual. So what emerges from here, from our opening 5 verses, is a set of ideas. Number one, if I take the parable read, then everything here is meant to convey a message for me. It's not simply details of the event. This is the name of the place. It's meant to give me a lesson. Right, utz, etzah, counsel, advice. That's one key point that we're meant to draw from here. Number two, Job is presented as being extremely righteous, although the terms that are used do not give us positive acts of righteousness as much as he's not sinful and he stays clear of sinning. He has great wealth. There's a sense of completeness in his wealth in the numbers that we see here. And he's concerned about his children's righteousness, and so at the end of their cycle of feasts that they have, where they're all getting along and eating together, he brings offerings in case they have done something wrong, in case they have blasphemed, which I'm still stuck on a little bit. I don't know why that would be his concern. Meaning, is that a normal thing to do at a feast?
He's about protecting his children.
Yeah.
Protecting
them. True. But why would I have assumed blasphemy in particular?
In case the sisters were not, they weren't showing how the sisters behaved in the situation.
But,
so
just kind
of,
I don't know.
Maybe there was drinking there, and then when you drink, you sort of say things that, you know, like.
Right. No, I absolutely, I agree. Drinking is for sure a part of this scene. the question in my mind is just, what else? Why blasphemy in particular? What is it about blasphemy that's what he's worried about?
Because maybe he's scared that he will be punished if his children spoke against Hashem.
So you think this is personal?
What?
You think it's personal that it's about him?
It's personal.
That's an interesting idea.
I think that he would bless them at a feast, because even on Shabbat, you automatically bless your children.
Right, but there's no mention here of him blessing his kids. That we don't get. We don't get that. But that's an interesting idea, that it's about himself.
Also, maybe protect himself. This is maybe the largest sin there is, and therefore it might encompass everything there is.
Right. So it could be that this is simply that this is, you know, one of the gravest out there. It's one of the Noahai laws. So therefore, even if he's not Jewish, this applies, you know, to all people, and that would be an issue potentially. I think there's something else, but okay, what would you do with it?
But if he wasn't afraid that they were sinning, why does it say he would do this all the days? If he was really afraid, he wouldn't be doing it all the days.
What do you mean?
If he was afraid that they were sinning.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't he stop it? Why would he do it all the days?
Because he's not fearing every single day.
Why wouldn't he stop? No, you're asking why doesn't he stop them from having the feasts? Well, he doesn't know whether they've sinned or not. You mean he should walk into the feasts and say, you know what, let me actually monitor this and make sure. The thing is that his fear is actually about a thought that they're having. Take a look again at verse number 5. They're not Jewish. They can do whatever they like. They're doing Sunday too. Verse 5 says, Berchu Elokim bilvavam. He's worried about a thought. So is this simply an illustration of extreme piety? And that's what this is about. Maybe the issue is that the book is trying to say that Job is so extreme in his piety that he's worried about a sin in one's heart, and the only sin then that's going to come to mind, what is a sin in one's heart, would be something idolatrous, something blasphemous. Because other than that, that which one thinks in his heart does not carry liability. So maybe that's what this is. Maybe that's why this is chosen. Rita.
Well, isn't that the lesson? Like, that people go through certain emotions and actions, but only God knows what's in our heart, what's in our thoughts. And,
yes.
And that is very often what we might be getting some punishment for, or something that people aren't aware of. Is that the lesson there?
I don't know. I mean, my jury is out still. But I think there's one more element that's important here. Yeah.
I kind of like Kitty's explanation, because he's so perfect, he does everything right. And so why is he, the sacrifice is not for him, for anything, because really a pious person would be always searching your own heart and thinking, what have I done wrong, maybe I did something wrong, and you don't have any indication of that. It's what they did wrong. And so maybe, like Kitty's explanation, that he's doing it...
He'll be blamed for.
But not only that, I mean, he's safeguarding his own future. He's a very wealthy man. You know, how did he accumulate all this wealth? So he's safeguarding, I think, by doing these sacrifices in his household, he's safeguarding that there isn't any blemish.
Right. So you're not talking about why blasphemy versus anything else, though. Just in general, this is an attempt to safeguard his legacy.
Yeah.
Could be. I mean, it makes sense. And I think it does fit the profile of somebody who is Yirei Elokim, right? Somebody who is God-fearing, wants to make sure that this doesn't happen. But I want to add one more note to this. And that is that the theme of blasphemy is going to be the theme of the book. Right? We spend time on this issue of, are you allowed to challenge God or not? Is it heretical, or is it evil within Judaism for him to say, I want to call up God on charges because he's dealt with me in such an unjust way? If that's not blasphemy, right? If it's not blasphemy for you to say what he is going to say in this book, I don't know what is. He's going to claim God doesn't run this world. God has outsourced it to the constellations. He allows good people to suffer miserably. That's what he's going to say in this book. So here, what we are presented with in the beginning is Eob's doing really well. Everything is going great. And he is worried that his children might be blaspheming, and therefore he brings offerings on a regular basis to make sure that if anything's been done wrong, he's going to set it right with God. But another couple of chapters from now, well, in just another chapter, his wife is going to say to him to blaspheme. She's going to say, Baruch Elohim Vamut. She's going to say to him, blaspheme against God and die. That's her advice. The look, you know, different spouses have different relationships. You haven't even seen his insurance policy. But that's where this is. I think fitting in. He is anti-blasphemy in the beginning when things are going well. He is afraid of it. His wife tries to induce it, and still he won't do it. But when his suffering reaches the threshold where he can't bear it anymore, he himself is going to do this. This is an arc in the book. It's a significant arc, and I think that's part of why we are told this in the beginning. All the other suggestions, I think, are important. But I think you can't miss the arc of what's happening with this idea in the book itself. We have more to see on this still, so I'm gonna take the reins now for just a couple of minutes. I apologize, but I want to make sure to address a few other things here. The book begins with Iyov Shemo. Right? His name is Job, but his name is mentioned first, and then the word, this is his name. That's an odd thing for us within Tanakh, to see somebody named in this manner. And if you take a look at source number 6 on your sheet, you find a Medrash. The ear of Medrash is always open to catch anomalies. Take a look at this one. Rubam shel tzadikim shmam kodem lahazkarasam. Mostly, when you see a righteous person appear, the word name, shemam, the word name, shame, will appear before they are mentioned, before you actually get their name. So they give examples. Ushmo Manoach, Manoach, father of Shimshon of Samson. So he's introduced as, his name was Manoach. Ushmo Elkanah, his name was Elkanah. Ushmo Yishai, his name was Yishai. Ushmo Boaz, his name was Boaz. But then there's an opposite pattern for the wicked, where it says name last. Naval, who had mocked King David and was involved in his own fight, Naval Shemo. Goliath, bad one. His name, also, Goliath was his name. Sheva ben Bichri, another one from David's life. Sheva ben Bichri was his name. So that leads me to believe, if I stop there, Iyov Shemo, that must mean he's a bad guy. And that's what the Medrash wants to prevent. Sometimes it will say, they will use the order for that's associated with the wicked, but he's actually righteous. So what the Medrash is doing is, the Medrash is presented with the opportunity to see something negative for Iyov, which it could have used to justify his suffering in the book and say, aha, in the very beginning we had a clue, Iyov Shemo, he's really a bad guy, and that's why all this happens. And the Medrash says, no, don't take that opportunity. Don't use this as your chance to say, Iyov Shemo, that means he's like Goliath. That means he's a bad one. Don't do it. Iyov is actually good. Now, there are other exceptions to this rule also. There's like Ushmo Lavan. There are others in Tanakh who are also exceptions. But I'm bringing you this in order to show you that the sages in the Midrash have the opportunity to pick on Job and say, aha, and they don't. That's number one. Number two, Dad Mikra suggests something really interesting is going on when we're told about his children and his wealth. Verse 1 ended with, he's righteous and he's good and he's God-fearing and he stays away from evil. And then it went right into when he had 7 sons and 3 daughters and he had 500 this and 500 that. And the suggestion is that maybe this is meant to be cause and effect. In other words, the challenge of theodicy, good people suffering and so on, and where is God's justice, does not begin when Satan rolls in and starts to attack him, which we haven't gotten to yet, but rather it actually begins at the very beginning of the book. Because in the first part of the book, it's going the way that the Sumerians like. Right? In the first part of the book, it's Iyov is nice, he's complete, he's God-fearing, he does everything right, and And therefore, he has 7 sons and 3 daughters, and therefore he becomes really wealthy, and everybody's getting along, and all that, until crash, you know, in verse 6. But maybe that's actually part of the story. You follow? The reason why Dat Mikra does this is because Dat Mikra is very into showing that the story part in the beginning and the dialogues in the middle are one integral whole. It's not that the dialogues are parachuted in. It's that this is actually one piece. And the question of, are people rewarded for their righteousness, is meant to start from the beginning of the book, not from the dialogues in the middle. So that's why they do this. But it's a very interesting point. It's sort of setting up the opposition, or setting up the problem that's going to show up in another couple of verses. Last point that I wanted to make sure to get to is the role of these offerings. I mentioned that the korban, the offering he brings, is a korban olah, a burnt offering from which one receives nothing. That fits very well with the idea that Iyov is Yirei Elokim. He is somebody who reveres God. He fears God. But it's not an expression of love. The olah may be taken as a demonstration of yirah, I'm afraid. It's not a shlamim, a celebration offering, or a todah, a thanks offering, in which you eat some and the priests eat some and there's a big party. This is the offering of an ascetic, somebody who says, I'm taking that which I have and I'm giving it away. That's the vision of the burnt offering. And I think that's consistent with what we've seen. And what this does here, in addition to that, I'll add another note in terms of this korban concern. Any sins of the children, any sins they have committed, have now undergone a ritual of atonement, right? Anything they've done wrong has now been atoned for, because every single week after they meet, they do this thing, right? They do this offering, right? I'm going to tell you what's coming. His kids are all going to die, right? So what we're doing here is setting up the problem. Telling me about the offerings that he brings is not only a description of Job is wonderful, Job brings gifts to God. It's also, therefore his kids should have a clean slate. And therefore what's about to happen to them makes no sense in the scheme of things. They shouldn't be suffering. They should be fine. So you follow what I'm trying to say here is that the korban here, the offering that Job brings, plays a role in setting up the problem. Job is good. His kids, even if they've sinned, have brought these offerings with him. Therefore, they should be good. The slate should be clean. Why then are they going to die in another couple of verses? So it's already the beginning, setting up the problem for the book. So in sum, and we're not going to sum up an hour's worth of material in the next minute and a half, but what we've seen is we have established, well, first of all, I brought the Sumeria piece in the beginning, but we've established the idea that Utz is a message, perhaps it's not a place name, it's a message. Think about this book. We've seen Job's righteousness described as being righteousness between people, as well as righteousness towards God, but perhaps it's more along the lines of do no harm. We've seen he has great wealth, which may be a result of his righteousness. We've seen he has a large number of children, a complete number of children, which may be seen as a product of his righteousness. We've seen that the kids all get along and they have these feasts, and that afterward Job brings this offering to atone for them, concerned about blasphemy in their hearts. Maybe he picks that sin specifically because it's a Noahide sin, it applies to everybody. Maybe because it's such a grave sin, it's one of the greatest that you could actually imagine. Maybe it's because he's thinking of a sin of thought. That shows us just how extreme he is, and blasphemy is an example of that, but I think it is part of an arc in the story, because we're going to see blasphemy as a theme in the book itself. But already from the beginning, we have the ingredients for where this is going in terms of the problem of suffering, in terms of the problem of righteous people suffering, in terms of whether Job is good or is not good. And what we'll have to do next week, God willing, is find out who exactly this Satan creature is, who is going to be licensed, in fact, to attack Job. So what I hope to do next time is at least to get through sentences 6 through 12, maybe even, well, I don't want to say maybe even, we'll get through what we get through. Again, as I said in our first week, I'm playing with format here, trying to figure out what works for people. Please be in touch with feedback on it. I'm going to send out, I hope, later today, a link to where you can find the recordings from the classes, and I hope that you'll take advantage of that as well on weeks that you need to miss. Thank you very much.
I just asked the question.